This is an ABC podcast.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
We're talking energy policy today on the Conversation Hour, away from the issues of coronavirus that is facing the state. So when you flick on the switch, you expect the light to come on, don't you? Australia has a reliable power grid that we rely on for our homes, our businesses, recreation, and even the welfare of animals, which you'll hear from in a minute. But climate change, bushfire smoke, and changes in the energy mix might be making things harder for the power grid. The Australian Energy Market Operator, which manages electricity and gas systems and markets across Australia, has warned that Australia's energy grid was pushed to the limit last summer, barely making it through without major outages. It warns that unless investment is increased, particularly in the operating system during periods of high temperatures and investing in bushfire-resistant infrastructure, this situation could get worse. So we're going to find out more about that today. But wait, there's more. Labor have also released their energy plan as well. Opposition leader Anthony Albanese has offered bipartisan support to the Prime Minister on energy. But there's conditions on Labor's support, saying it won't back nuclear power, but it's prepared to support carbon capture and storage projects only if there's new funding mechanisms for it. So what does that mean? What does this mean for the energy grid and how it works in Australia? And what should Australia do about its energy future? Are we getting it right? Are we getting it wrong? And what don't you know that you'd like to ask?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
Let's begin this program by going to Lang Lang, where Alan Bullen is. He's the president of the Australian Chicken Growers Council, an industry very reliant on power and has had to deal with things like power outages and so forth in the past. Alan, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you very much.
How important is power to your industry?
Power in between food and water for the chickens. Power is up there. It's one of the three main items that we need to grow chickens. So it's very, very vital. And the technology, as we improve to get better animal welfare, better product for the customers, power is becoming more and more vital to the way we grow them.
Why is power important for growing chickens?
Well, we provide the perfect atmosphere in the shed for a chicken to grow. So, you know, it's not too hot, it's not too cold. We maintain the temperature at within a degree of perfect growing conditions, perfect welfare conditions for the whole life of the batch. And that has to be done artificially. And so that's done with heaters, coolers and fans to get the right amount of air in the sheds.
Now, you had a lot of problems when there was a summer of blackouts a couple of summers ago. We've just got a new report from the Australian Energy Market Operator saying it was a close-run thing this summer with the reliability of the power grid, with bushfires and smoke affecting things like solar and power transmission, actually made things very difficult for the grid. What do you think about the state of Australia's power grid right now?
If we look at last summer, we only just scraped through. And really, in terms of weather conditions, it was a mild summer. I know we had the bushfires and that, but that was an accumulation of dry period. It wasn't that we had days and days of 40-degree heat. So it really concerns me from a farmer's point of view. If we go and get weather that I can remember as a child many years ago, where you'd get a week, 10 days of 35, 40-degree heat, our power system is not going to cope. So that is a concern, and as we move through, our infrastructure is getting older, it's not being replaced, and so therefore every year we go on, we sneak through, but we're putting pressure on the following year to get the same result.
Is it getting better or getting worse?
Oh, look, it's getting worse. I think there's a bigger demand on power, and people are expecting more. I mean, everything you buy is run by electricity. Solar is taking some of that away, but But really, I mean, there was a great big thing about Hazelwood closing down. Look, that was some of the concern. Maybe we should have handled that better in the sense that we should have had some facilities in place to compensate that. But at the end of the day, it comes back to our grid and moving electricity around. And that's the area that we probably are going to fail in. And as we were talking earlier, we could get there from a political point of view and say we need to allocate money to repair the grid. But I question whether that's actually a clever move in the sense that we could, it's such a big job and such an expensive job, we could be halfway through that scenario and technology will overtake the repairs.
This is something that's obviously a great concern to your industry because you've gotten involved in sitting on sort of power committees, looking at this, working with power companies and so forth. What has your industry done to respond to the lack of reliability, if you will, of power?
We have to have backup generators on our farms. So we're provided that, but as I said, they are meant to be backup generators. At no stage did we think that they were going to become our main source of power. And as each year that goes on, we're running our generators more and more and more with compulsory closures for a couple of hours on every day as they move around the state, shut areas down to transfer that power to areas that need it. And we're going to see more and more of that on hot days where areas are shut down for an hour. And so we're doing that. The other thing that we are looking at, which I hope will give the industry some security in the future, is solar. But the solar in the sense that, as it is at the moment, why it provides helps substitute the price of electricity, it doesn't solve your issues on a hot day. So we need to get into batteries. But at the moment, the batteries are very expensive. Doesn't make the project a viable proposition. The lifetime of the batteries is very questionable at the moment. So from a farming point of view, I suppose the perspective of the future will be big solar, batteries. If we don't have power, well, we can cope. There is a move by a lot of power companies to go to microgrids where they'll get a town and put solar onto buildings and those buildings provide the power for that town. Is a great idea, but that's going to take a long time to flow out in the whole of Australia. And as we do that, there's going to be other issues that we need to address. So, look, there are things out there that we're excited about where we could go, but we have to deal with what's here now. And what's here now is we're not going to have power over if we get a really hot summer. It's going to be a very interesting scenario for a lot of farmers here in Victoria.
What's the answer then, from your point of view, Alan? Simple question.
If I had the answer, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I'd be selling it to the government. I don't know what the answer is. We're all going to have to... I think it's a little bit not expecting to have the reliability of power. And I suppose I disagreed a little bit with some of the power companies. There seems to be at the moment a basis of thought between pricing and reliability, and they're saying that you can't have both. You can't have reliability and a cheap power product. And they seem to be going for the price factor. I believe there's people out there, and farmers are one of those people, that would pay a bit more for power if they had reliability. So even the power companies haven't quite sure what is more prevalent to their customers, whether it's the price or reliability. So that's a challenge they're going to have to face up with in the next 4 or 5 years is do they charge more and provide a good, reliable source of power, or do they sell it cheap and people are going to have to be prepared that every couple of days they haven't got power for 3 or 4 hours?
Well, we've got the experts coming up. We'll ask them just that. Alan Bullen, thanks very much for joining us, though.
Okay, thank you. Have a nice day.
That's Alan Bullen there from Lang Lang. He's a chicken grower talking about his issues with power and why it's important. Let's go to Tony Wood now, Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, who can talk to us a fair bit about the situation we find ourselves in with power in Australia. Tony, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Good morning. Love to be on.
Should we start where Alan left off, talking about the trade-off between trying to get more reliability or and having to pay more for it, or having cheaper power at less reliability? Is that really the trade-off that we see in the power grid for Australia?
Well, I guess to some extent it is. And I think Alan's comments reflect the reality that there are many people who would put more value on reliability than Alan, and many people who would put less value on more reliability than Alan. And that's one of the challenges, because the way our system has been set up most of its history is that we provide a single standard of reliability for everybody. What that's meant is that only in very unusual circumstances would people say, look, I really do need a more reliable system. I run a hospital or an airport or something like that. I'm prepared to put my own backup diesel generator or gas generator in my basement, and I can depend upon that and turn that on if I need it. Now, I think what we're seeing is technology, which gives people greater flexibility to do that. And so one of the things that the market operator talked about earlier in this program is able to do is starting to talk to customers who are more than happy to turn off to reduce their consumption at certain times if the commercial deal's right, because they don't put a higher value on reliability, and make sure that, say, someone like Alan, who needs that power maybe better, more urgently than they do, might be prepared to pay a bit more. Now, that flexibility is something that's really only being introduced now, because I think it's taken a long time for us to recognise that the fundamental system is changing, and we need to change not just the technology of the generation towards lower emissions, which is the other third part of the trade-off, but also to make sure that we can manage the system better. And, you know, the management systems and the technologies we use to do that are becoming available, but they're a little behind where they need to be. And it's this catch-up phase which is causing the sort of stress that people like Alan are experiencing. And I'm thinking that we're going to get through this, but you can see that in last summer and probably summer before, things were pretty tight when major things go wrong that weren't expected.
And you're right, there is sort of multiple things in this debate, isn't there? There's the reliability, there's the cost, there's also the environment, which has become a major part of where we debate and we talk about what should be happening with the energy policy in Australia. I suppose just before we move on to some of that, you mentioned the market operator. They said it was a close run thing over last summer. Is that something you agree with?
Well, I certainly, there were some concerns. I mean, going into last summer, we had predictions of a pretty unpleasant weather patterns. And also we had two major generating units, one at the gas-fired power station at Mortlake and one at Latrobe Valley, in the Latrobe Valley at Loy Yang A. They were offline. And it was touch and go for a while as to when they were going to be brought back online. It was supposed to be around about Christmas time. As it turned out, they were brought back, and we managed to get through that okay. And there was really only one particularly nasty problem. There was a very bad storm went through the very end of January, and that took out the main interstate connector between Victoria and South Australia. In fact, some of the facilities, including the Mortlake gas-fired power station, which is in Western Victoria, was effectively on the western side of where the transmission line was broken. That then became isolated from the rest of Victoria, and that was a challenge for 17 days, I think. Now, those things sometimes happen, and it's why we make sure that, or the operator makes sure, they've always got some degree of reserve. This time they managed the reserve very well, and as a result of that, we did get through. Now, I think we'll see what this summer, there are a lot of information we might want to talk about of what might change this coming summers. But, I think we've learned an awful lot about how to manage the system. And, I think not just the climate change issue itself, but the weather patterns have been changing. You could argue a lot about whether or not how much of this is due to what sort of climate change effects. But what we are seeing is increasing periods of high temperature, but just as importantly, several days in a row of hot temperatures. And that's when things can get quite stressed.
And just in terms of the summers we're experiencing in the bushfires we've had, even all the way back to Black Saturday, there's been talk and recommendations to put more power underground. Has that been happening?
Look, in a lot of new suburbs now, that's what happens, right? In fact, you go into some of the new suburbs, and if you've grown up and lived in suburbs that have got above ground power lines, you look at these new suburbs sort of trying to work out, why does this all look a bit different? And you suddenly realise there's no power lines. Now, The challenge, of course, is that there's a significant cost. They're significantly more expensive, particularly when you're starting to run power lines from interregional towns and so forth, to put them underground. Firstly, there's a good reason to do that. Firstly, it makes them more resilient. Secondly, they don't tend to, they themselves, not only do they not get taken out by violent storms and so forth, but they're underground. They don't potentially contribute to bushfires. And there's been some evidence that that's happened during the Black Saturday fires. So there's some good reasons to do it. The cost premium, however, is very significant. And so whilst there have been some changes to do that, we're seeing it being done steadily. And the point that Alan made, which is the other interesting one that's now a technology available alternative, and that is to say, look, in some cases, there are parts of regional Victoria where it would make more sense rather than run a long transmission line, which would be either very expensive underground or potentially a problem if it was above ground, why not just have a local power station? Now, that's the way we used to produce power many, many, many years ago with lots more local generators. But the idea that you could do it now with some combination of renewable energy and storage, battery storage, may be the way to go. It's not quite there yet for many places. Many people who are farmers would understand that. They may be already off the grid, but they would often have a backup generator. So working out the right combination of technologies is still something we haven't got quite right, but it is going to be a continuing battle or balancing act between, if we were to, for example, if we wanted to provide enough power to be almost certain that we would never not have enough on really peak days when everyone's running their air conditioners, which is becoming more of an issue, we'd spend an enormous amount of money and that capacity would hardly ever be used. Do we really want to do that, or are there better ways of managing the system on those hot days? And I think it's the chasing that prize of managing the system better is where we need to go.
Tony Wood is with us, Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, on the Conversation Hour today. We're talking about the power and the energy system that we have in Australia, where improvements can be made, and some of the difficulties. Also answering questions that you don't know about. Nikki in Cheltenham wanted to know more about why we can't put power lines underground. Hopefully that answered your question. Nikki says, it looks like a third world country. Trees slashed around them, wooden poles, it's insane. More text coming in. We'll get to those in a moment. Peter has called from Wangaratta. Hi, Peter. What do you want to know about power?
Well, I'm really quite disgusted. I went to the great expense to put solar panels on my home and my parents' home. And no sooner than we put the solar on, that our electricity tariff increased by 25%. And in the mail this week, we got letters saying that the feed-in tariff is going to drop 12 cents down to 10 cents, which is a 20% drop. So I'm paying 25% more than I was paying for power before I put solar on my roof. And now the feed-in tariff's been dropped by another 20%, and I think it's totally unacceptable.
Peter, it's a dodgy phone line, so I don't want to talk too much longer too, but it, just in terms of something really quick, does that mean it's going to take you, or do you think you'll be able to pay off those solar panels now the costs have changed?
I'll be paying them off, but it's going to take a lot longer, and it's just so unfortunate because we're saying we've been told to put solar panels on our roof, and we're being penalised, we're being taxed, you know, by the energy supplier and the retailers for trying to do the right thing.
Peter, thank you so much for your call. That's Peter in Wangaratta there. Mark's in Shepparton on the phone line as well. Hi, Mark. What do you want to say?
Yes, I'd just like to say briefly, I was pretty disgusted with Labor and Albanese's policy on power and cooperating with the Morrison government.
Why is that?
They've ruled out nuclear power, and I think it's going to be a real part of our, essential part of our mix. It's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, and the technology's just moved on so much in the last few years. And they've got basically what they call SMRs, small scale reactors. It's virtually the size of something you sit on the back of a truck.
Nuclear is constantly ruled out in Australia, Mark. Does that frustrate you as somebody who's clearly keen on the idea?
Yes, it does. Because I think there's an old... Every time you're making nuclear, someone says Chernobyl or something. Well, it's like comparing a T Model Ford to the latest Mercedes-Benz.
Let's ask our expert, Mark. Thanks very much for calling. Tony Wood, Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute. What are your thoughts on nuclear energy? Mark's obviously fairly keen. Anthony Albanese and the Labor Party have ruled it out. Where do you sit on nuclear?
Well, I think nuclear has gone through, like a lot of other things, gone through a lot of stages, and it certainly, I think some of what Mark said, I completely agree with, and it's hard to have a proper conversation because there are these very, very, and when I use the word emotive, I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, people are genuinely concerned about nuclear power because they've seen these horrendous pictures of what goes on when these things fail. Now, you know, Australia is an unusual country in a sense that we have, we export a lot of uranium. We have an enormous percentage of the world's known uranium resource, and yet we don't produce electricity from nuclear. In fact, at the moment, it is illegal to produce electricity from nuclear power, and that remains the case. There was, if I recall, sometime in the late 1960s, early 70s, when there was a proposal to build a nuclear power station in Victoria. I've actually got a newspaper clipping from that at that time. And the reason it wasn't built is because at that around about then, we worked out how to make really big coal-fired power stations really cheap. And that killed the economics of nuclear at the time. It had very little to do with whether or not it was dangerous. It was all to do with the economics. And today, I think Mark's right in what he implied in what he said, is that the very big nuclear power stations that the world's been used to and that you tend to see on, you know, on The Simpsons, for example, they're the things that people are scared about. They're very big. They're very very expensive. And the one even being built in the UK at the moment is horrendously expensive. Now, they do have the advantage of they don't produce, don't affect climate change, but they do have some very significant costs associated with ensuring that they're safe and ensuring they can be cleaned up. The interesting question is the one that Mark alluded to, and that is this idea of small modular reactors. Now, the one I just talked about in the UK is about 3,000 megawatts. Now, that's about twice the size of the Hazelwood Power Station that was shut down a couple of years ago, and more recently was the towers were all blown up and people might have even seen them falling over. That's about twice as big as that. What we're now talking about is the possibility of having small modular nuclear reactors, which would be about 100 megawatts. You'd need a pretty big truck to cart them around, but they can certainly be, they are modular, they're very safe, and they could be quite, therefore they could be installed in different parts of the grid. The problem is they're still very expensive. Relative to what we've also seen is nuclear has been around for a long time. The costs of solar and wind have come down so dramatically. Now, we are having to manage the intermittency of wind and solar, and we can talk about that, I think, during this program. But the issue of nuclear would be, if we find that we can get through to where we need to be with renewable energy, mostly wind and solar, then the role of nuclear might be quite small, particularly if it's expensive. But I think Australia does need to be kept.
There's always the issue of waste, too, with nuclear, though,
exactly.
Isn't there? There's no nuclear system that doesn't produce waste, and then the issue becomes what you do with that.
Pretty well. I mean, the amount of waste you produce from a nuclear power station is a tiny fraction of the amount of waste you produce from a coal-fired power station. It's just that we've never thought about carbon dioxide as waste. So the amount is actually quite relatively small, but it hangs around for an awful long time, and so does CO2, to be fair. Now, there are technologies which can actually reuse the waste in the same way that gold miners can go back over old tailings and still find gold. The same thing can be applied with nuclear, and those technologies are still being developed. They're still not in the point of being commercial. So there's a lot of things happening in nuclear. If I was running the Australian government, I would be saying, let's keep an eye on this. Because there are some uncertainties ahead with Plan A, which is fundamentally to move towards renewables with backup storage. But if that Plan A turns out to be challenging and very expensive, we better keep an eye on what's going on in the rest of the world. In some countries who don't have the resources we have, they may very well find that nuclear is better for them. They may drive down the cost of nuclear. And it may mean that in the future, those small modular reactors do become part of our system. I suspect it's unlikely, but it's possible.
1300 222 774 if you want to join the conversation. You can text 0437 774 774. We're going to go to a much smaller example of a power situation in just a moment. But before that, I did want to ask you, Tony Wood, who's with us from the Grattan Institute, what is the cheapest form of energy that we can build in Australia right now?
Well, that comes back to this question of cost and reliability. So in terms of building new energy, putting aside a lot of old coal-fired power stations are now pretty cheap because they've been there for a long time and paid off. It's almost certainly the case that solar and wind are pretty much the cheapest in terms of producing the energy when they produce it. The problem, of course, is that they don't produce it 24/7, and so you need to have backup. And so when you think about a system, I mean, I'll give you a specific example. I've got a small farm property that I sometimes escape to when I'm allowed to under the COVID lockdown, and it's got solar on the roof, it's got a battery, and it works pretty well most of the time. And that solar, and certainly once it's installed, it's effectively zero cost. The trick is that every now and again I need my diesel generator as backup, and that is expensive. So getting the right cost balance of my system's important. When you think about a city the size of Melbourne, making sure that we have the appropriate balancing technologies when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining is not a trivial problem, but it can be done, and we're getting much better at it. So I think in some ways our system will be a combination of technologies which overall will be at the lowest cost. But to say that one is cheaper than the other when you need a mix is probably not quite the right way to think about it. What we want to have is the lowest overall cost of our electricity, and some of it will be very cheap when it's available, and some will be more expensive to cover those periods when the cheap stuff is not available.
Damn it, I just wanted the spreadsheet there, Tony. Thank you very much for answering it anyway.
I'll send you a spreadsheet.
Up next on the Conversation Hour, though, we will go to a town doing things differently. Yep, we're going to head to Yakandanda.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
Let's go to Yakandanda. I said we would, to a volunteer-run community group that formed to try and power their town with renewable energy. Matt Charles-Jones is the chairperson from Totally Renewable Yakandanda, a group that has been in the headlines for trying to do this work for some time, as I said, from way back in 2014. Matt, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me in.
How successful have you been in powering your town with renewable energy?
Yeah, well, terrifically so. We think there's still work to be done, but what we do know across Yakandanda, there is a pushing 60% of buildings with solar on the roof. And more importantly than that, there's a really strong belief and ambition amongst most people in the town that we can really do electricity differently and do so in a way that saves people money. It also becomes part of a collective rebuilding of local economy and address the key question around climate change. So we're feeling really satisfied, but we also know there's a lot of work to be done to go. Yeah.
Well, so what's the plan? We were talking earlier about some towns trying to effectively create their own power grid and be effectively off the rest of the connected system and run it themselves. Is that something that you want to do in Yakandanda, or is it different to that?
Well, we sort of go through phases of understanding. Originally, we had anticipated we were going to disconnect from the main grid. But once we started to understand the cost of doing that and also some of the favourable values of staying connected to the grid, we've really now got focused on mini-grids and collections of microgrids. And so what that means is individual properties have solar systems and batteries where it makes sense, and that we connect those together with a smart energy control device. And there's a diversity of those on the market. The one we're using is called a Mondo Ubi. So really, how do you create a smart network of local energy generators and users to cooperate on a collective outcome on reliable electricity?
So that means you don't have to have a big facility somewhere full of batteries. A lot of houses have their own batteries and own solar, but they're connected to each other. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And so the cheapest form of electricity is that you can produce on your own house and save it if you can. And obviously, if you're using less electricity overall, that is even cheaper. But yes, so if you're not using all of your electricity in Yakandanda, you have capability of exporting that to others in the town. We capture that via the smart energy controller. And we've also worked really hard in Yakandanda to support the establishment of a community-owned retailer. And that entity is called Indigo Power. And essentially what you're doing is you're buying and selling electricity via a community-owned retailer.
So people still get a power bill, but it's from your community-owned group.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we don't produce enough electricity to power everybody, but there is a component of that which will be locally generated and used. And one of the
I read you want to achieve energy sovereignty though by 2022? Does that mean basically you produce enough energy to power the town?
Yeah, correct, for right through the year. And so, as I say, there's a bit of work to be done, but also what we're conscious of is that there is a mass transition and perhaps disruption in the energy industry, and we really want to be part of the story about changing people's expectations about what can be done, and not only that, what can be done in a way that benefits local community. And so, for example, Indigo Power will be returning 50% of their proceeds and profits back to community energy projects. So it becomes self-perpetuating that you're investing in new local assets to benefit local people and obviously at the same time benefit the planet from a climate change viewpoint.
Matt Charles-Jones, thanks very much for telling us a little bit about what you're doing in Yackandandah today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Chairperson from Totally Renewable Yackandandah. It's probably a good time to bring in Simon Holmes-Accord, who's a Senior Advisor, Climate and Energy College at Melbourne University. You can join us now whilst we talk about a town that's going renewable, as you just heard, for a lot of climate reasons, but also trying to form companies and run an energy business themselves. Simon Holmes-Accord, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Thanks, Warwick. Thanks for having me on.
What does the Yackandandah story mean, if anything, for the wider energy grid that we have in Australia?
Yackandandah shows us that with clever management systems, with the digitalisation of our grid, we're able to integrate more and more renewables at a lower cost, but provide reliability to the standard expected by the consumers. It's a great example, and we'll see versions of it at different scales through our grid over the coming years.
Does it take a town to decide to do this, or are there other ways and other methods that you've seen people sort of try and create their own piece of the energy market?
Yeah, it happens at different scales. Like over in Western Australia, the grid operator there has worked out that a lot of their customers at the edge of grid are much more expensive to service, the having few customers on long power lines, and are moving to microgrids or individual standalone on houses. But if you sort of zoom out to the whole country, we're doing it at a greater scale, where we are increasing the amount of renewables in every state, because it's the cheapest way of bringing new energy in. But in order to keep the reliability up, we need to make sure we've got the dispatchable energy and the interconnectedness. So I'm not sure that Yackandandah will ever want to cut the cable with the rest of the grid, because it will give them just that extra bit of reliability and the ability to export any surplus. We have strong grid going between Victoria, New South Wales, and increasingly to South Australia and Tasmania, which allows us to share power in both directions.
We've been speaking a bit today about the energy market operator and their report looking back at the last 12 months or so. As someone who looks a lot at renewables and transitioning towards renewables, some of the things that came up in that report include like bushfire smoke affecting solar performance, heat and so forth on affecting renewables performance in the grid itself. What do you make of those concerns, and have we got ways for renewables to handle those strains in future summers?
Yeah, the key thing, the report talks a lot about the accuracy of predictions. So for the first time ever, we saw a small but noticeable effect of the smoke on solar generation. I think it was down about 6%. And wind and solar, particularly coal and gas, at the extreme temperatures above 40 degrees, we start to see a degrading of the amount of, their maximum power that they put out can reduce as well. So we're getting a lot better, and the AEMO were very proud that they've reduced their forecasting error, meaning that they're getting better and better at predicting. So they're constantly orchestrating the grid. You've got the wind and the solar moving around with the weather, and the coal power stations that are chugging away down in Latrobe Valley, and in the middle sit a number of technologies that flexibly fill in the difference, keeping the lights on. And AEMO's done a fantastic job of that. They said it was a challenging summer, But of the three levels of a sort of emergency in the grid for lack of reserve, they got no more than level two, only twice in Victoria, and never once got to the point over summer where they had to turn customers off due to any lack of power.
Peter from West Essendon asked this question on the text. He says, is the grid being updated to handle the large amount of solar already and still being built? How does solar incorporate itself into the grid when it's not something that's generating electricity all of the time, for obvious reasons?
Yeah, so one of the big processes at the Energy Market Operator is called the Integrated System Plan. And that was kicked up a massive amount. It's 3 years since the Finkel review came out. Since 3 years this month, since Alan Finkel presented his report, and in that he tasked AEMO to prepare a very detailed plan of where we're going with our energy system, and a very key part of that is making sure we have the transmission as our grid is changing with demand and supply. Changes. We need to make changes to where our major transmission lines are, and that's so. There's a number of recommendations in that report to keep things going. But in general, the solar generators and the wind generators are putting themselves where there is good access to power lines. New South Wales is in the process of opening up a renewable energy zone in the west of the state where there hasn't traditionally been strong power. Power lines to carry the load, but they've just put up a process, put out results the other day showing massive interest from industry in building out there. So industry and government will be working hand in hand to get the power lines to bring that cheap renewables in from the west of their state.
And I suppose then just as a final question to you, Simon Holmes, a court who's been with us, what are the major things either hindering or that you're excited about for renewables entering the power grid and them fitting into the power supply?
Probably the most exciting thing is 3 years ago we were talking a lot about the energy trilemma, that we've balancing affordability, reliability and emissions was an incredibly difficult task, and I think many were talking about it as if it was an impossible task to get all three. In fact, back in 2017, not sure we had either. There was low confidence that we had affordable, reliable or low emissions. Well, this work that's come out of AEMO, the Integrated System Plan, plots a number of pathways forward for us. All of them have a significant shift towards renewables. In fact, the business as usual case has us at a 74% renewable grid in 20 years. Which would, and it's the cheapest path forward. They've done all the modelling to ensure that the scenario is reliable and it dramatically slashes our emissions. So we're now, just in a matter of 3 years, we've now got the confidence that we can transition our grid towards meeting those three goals of affordability, reliability and low emissions.
Well, Simon Holmes of Court, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's Simon Holmes, a Court Senior Advisor, Climate and Energy College, Melbourne University, speaking to us here today. Tony Wood's been with us, the Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, as have plenty of your text been coming in. There's a lot of questions being asked. This one saying Yakandanda is one thing, try to power a city with renewable energy is another. Doug from Boronia says, how about the heat and how it affects the grid? The grid loses efficiency and breaks down more on hot days regardless of whether or not there are renewables involved as well. Tony Wood, a lot of things were raised about renewables and how they fit in terms of the energy supply in Australia. Are they making things more reliable or less reliable for the Australian power grid?
I think the answer to your question of either or is yes. Look, what I mean by that is that every technology we talk about, whether it's coal or gas or solar or wind or wave technology or even nuclear, they all have different characteristics. None of them singularly is perfect. Some of them can produce really cheap electricity when they're running, but they don't produce much when they're not, and so forth. So putting them all together in a system that produces overall the lowest cost is the challenge. And as we transition, as we must, away from very large, centralised, mostly coal, but although sometimes hydro or gas, power generation, more or less produced in some big central locations like the Latrobe Valley, and sending that electricity around to our all of our towns and suburbs, to a system where the energy is going to be is more distributed on rooftops, in regional areas, regional wind farms and big solar farms and so forth. That's a big transition. And so as we go through that, there will be situations in where the challenges emerge. So whether it's high emissions, which is the problem with coal and gas, whether it's concerns about safety, which is the nuclear, to some extent the nuclear problem, or whether it's to do with the intermittency. Now, I wouldn't even use the word reliability in a sense, because there's nothing more reliable than the sun. It comes up, we can predict pretty well what time the sun's going to come up in 100 years' time. It's very reliable. But of course, it's predictably not going to be there during the nighttime, and at times clouds go across the sun. So what we're learning to do is, how do you integrate what is, when it's producing really cheap, with things that will balance that when it's not there? And that's not a criticism. It's just saying, look, we do know how to do this. And Simon was talking about some of the things that are heading in the right direction. As we learn how to integrate this better, then not only do we move more quickly towards wind and solar, but particularly probably in Australia's case, solar, we're also going to be able to manage those things a whole lot better. And Australia's really unusual in the world. There's not many places that have a lot of both wind and solar. So what they call this a lack of correlation, that is often the wind is blowing when the sun is not shining and vice versa. And so we are blessed with resources. Of course, like many things, making sure we don't abuse that blessing is one of our challenges.
Can I ask you a couple of really quick questions off our text line? First one, is Snowy 2 ever going to happen?
Look, this was a nation-building strategic project announced by a previous Prime Minister, and the government still seems to be keen to do it. My own view is that it's a very expensive and probably unjustified investment. The government seems committed to it, and the only thing that will determine really whether it happens is whether the government remains to be committed to it, I think.
Another one from Travis says, what about using green hydrogen to store the solar and wind power at night?
Right. Well, green hydrogen is a great idea. Hydrogen has got a lot of different applications. The idea here is, for people who aren't aware of it, is basically you can turn water into hydrogen using renewable electricity, and you can store the hydrogen more easily in a sense than you can store electricity in a battery, probably maybe more cheaply. And then you can put that hydrogen back through a fuel cell to produce electricity, and the only byproduct is water again. So it sounds perfect, right? Problem is that those electrolyzers to do that are still pretty expensive. Within the next few years, in the same way we saw happen with solar, the cost of producing that hydrogen will become much more affordable. And what that means is that over time, I am sure that the role of hydrogen will change dramatically in all sorts of ways. Whether or not it would make sense for hydrogen, whether hydrogen's better than batteries, will come down to the economics, and that's a little less clear yet. But hydrogen is really only now emerging as a really interesting potential across the entire energy system.
Speaking of potential, last one. Laurie from Burton's Lookout says, what's the latest on tidal and wave power technology?
The sea is a very unpleasant place for knocking things around. You put a piece of equipment in the ocean off the coast of Victoria and leave it there for a couple of days and see what happens. Look, that's some of the challenges with those technologies. They tend to be relatively modest and quite specific to individual locations. So in certain cases, particularly like some of the near mainland islands, for example, some of those technologies can be very effective. But broadly speaking, they don't tend to scale up in the same way that we need for particularly cities like, you know, the size of Melbourne, for example.
Well, Tony Wood, it's been brilliant to pick your brain anyway and work out a little bit more about power and the energy grid and how it's going. Should we be but worried about the summer ahead?
I wouldn't be worried, but I'd be certainly paying attention. Thanks, Warwick.
Paying attention, brilliant. Tony Wood, Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, as we talk our way through, well, what the energy grid is actually like, what the pressures on it, and what it means for costs and so forth. That's it for the Conversation Hour today. I hope, like me, you've learned a lot about the energy grid and how it works. But as always, we have many more questions which we'll endeavour to answer again in the future. Remember that you can listen to this or any other program by subscribing to the Conversation Hour podcast. And if you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you're thinking or who we should be talking to, you can email us conversationhour@abc.net.au. Catch you next time.